Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Sizzle on my lamppost. Trying to find a thought that's escaped her mind.
You ready to get intimate? Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your I'll Let You Cry of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
She never lets me in, only tells me where she's been, when she's had too much to drink. I say that I don't care, I just run my hands through her dark hair, then I pray to God you gotta help me fly away, and just let her cry. Tears fall down like rain, let her sing. If it eases all her pain, let her go. Let her walk right out on me. And if the sun comes up tomorrow, let her rain, let her rain.
It's part two. If you guys thought I wasn't going to go bonkers on this Hootie stuff, you haven't been listening very long. Last week, on the first part of Popcast, the Hootie cast, Tim Summer came through to talk about signing the band, and I kind of played a bunch of deep Hootie cuts, you know, basement tapes for the heads, real Hootie heads, no. This week, we're going to talk about what it was like to write about Hootie and the Blowfish, kind of at their peak. And we got two guests today. First, Danielle Smith, former editor-in-chief of Vibe, who I used to work for. And in the mid-90s, she was the music editor of Vibe, and she wrote about the second Hootie record in a very moving way. And so she's going to come on, and we're going to talk about all the feelings underneath that. And then we're going to close out with the boy Jim DeRogatis. You know Jim for his work on the R. Kelly allegations. But Jim in the 90s worked at Rolling Stone and famously kind of negatively reviewed Hootie, apparently in a way that offended a lot of people and somehow resulted in him losing his job. So we're going to talk about that. So we've got a little bit of a pro, a little bit of a con, but a lot of Hootie. So we're going to start off first. Danielle Smith is calling in. DSW, how you doing?
How are you, John Caramonica?
I miss you.
Miss you terribly.
So DSW, I know you were on retreat, and I'm sure part of that, if you're sitting in front of a computer, is that you're finishing your book, right?
Man, listen, I have written two novels, one called More Like Wrestling, which is actually celebrating its 15th anniversary. It's kind of a semi-autobiographical thing about my sister and I growing up in East Oakland. And then there's another novel, both of these are published by Random House, Crown Random House, called Bliss, which is about R&B girl who's kind of amazing.
Go cop these on Amazon.com.
They're there. But I'm moving into, you know, I'm stretching out with some narrative nonfiction.
And the book is called Shine Bright. It's about the history of Black women in pop, correct?
Yes. It's the story of how Black women took over American pop music and changed culture forever, which is absolutely true, John. And when the book comes out, you need to have me back on so we can argue about that, please.
What are we going to argue about when we both agree? What are we going to argue about? My Lord.
True. It's really hard and fun to write this book. It's been a long time coming, so I'm excited.
Well, I appreciate you taking a break so that we can get in this serious rucker business today.
Right? Mm. Tell the haters to stand down, John.
Really a no hate zone today. For those that don't know, me and DSW have deep, deep roots. Before I worked at the New York Times, which is a newspaper, I worked at Vibe Magazine. I was the music editor hired by Danielle, sometimes with wisdom, sometimes not. It was a momentous and an energized year and a half that we worked together. And Danielle is someone who I had been reading since I had been reading about music. And very crucially, in the mid-90s, Danielle was the music editor of Vibe. And this is like 1.0 era, early Vibe. And the first piece of writing about Hootie and the Blowfish that let me know that I was not totally off for liking them was by Danielle Smith. That is in the, I've got to check your Google Books Vibe archive. It is on the internet. June, July 96 issue with that Fugees cover. DSW, what do you call it when the heads of the people interrupt the Vibe on the magazine cover? Was that a name? Was there like a term for that?
I don't even know what you're asking me. If the heads of the people,
You know, like when the heads are, like when Wyclef's head is in front of the V, not behind the V.
Oh, that was a moment. In front of the logo?
That's what I'm saying, right? That was unusual. Yeah. I remember this cover.
Oh, yeah.
Very beautiful, vivid cover.
Yes.
The lead review. And for kids, if you don't know, when magazines existed and there were review sections, the lead review was the album every month that you wanted to give the biggest play and the most space to your writer to really go in. So the fact that the lead review of Vibe magazine in 1996 was Hootie and the Blowfish was already one thing. The fact that DSW came with these bars is a completely next level thing. I just want to read a quick bar right off the top, and then we'll get into the conversation. Rucker looks less like someone from the Black Rock Coalition, which we'll tell you about in a minute, than like someone black who joined a White Rock Coalition and started mentally hanging out with Dan Fogelberg, Ayo, and Bruce Springsteen, which is kind of what he did. Black Rock Coalition, if you don't know, was something from started in New York in the mid-80s. Vernon Reid from Living Color, Greg Tate, Peace to the OG, and a bunch of others formed a kind of informal network. I do miss getting those emails. I used to get those emails every week, and it was a great guide to things that were happening in New York. But you said, Darius, coming from a completely different perspective, but yet the essence of your takeaway, and we'll get to the kicker of your review shortly, but the essence of your takeaway is there's more going on within Darius than might be visible to the naked eye and naked ear, correct?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, I guess I understood it, but I completely resisted, and really I didn't have to resist it because I didn't feel any part of it. This idea that he was somehow like not good, or that he was corny, or that he was just like hanging with those white boys, or that he was, what do the kids call it now? That he was some kind of industry plant. I just never thought any of that. I heard his voice. And as a fan and also as a critic, I was won over like, what, four notes in to anything mm-hmm. he's ever sang?
Yeah, it's his voice is too signature. It's too profound. And just because the context that it is located in is maybe a slightly more conventional, it's not Nutre context at all, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very centrist
mm-hmm.
context.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't diminish the power of what he's doing vocally and also on some of the songs, what he's doing lyrically.
It doesn't. And I think sometimes, too, that even makes it more like he is kind of a plant on the inside of like what rock was like in the 90s.
Mm.
Like he was kind of revolutionary to me. Like I just thought that he was doing a thing that people thought that white people did. He was doing like, I am the hugest like Steve Perry fan
mm-hmm.
and I am the hugest Eddie Vedder fan. And he was doing that.
Absolutely. And not in a kind of derivative way, right?
No.
Like not in a kind of a facsimile sense.
No, he was doing that like, do you want somebody with like a big, massive voice to like own the entire world for a little bit with some like, who else is in Pearl Jam? Love them to death, right? But it's like, do you want that? Who else is in Journey? Right.
You got no
love
respect for the God Stone Gossard? What's up? What's up? No love for Jeff Ament?
Like, really, he could be sitting next to me right now and I'd just be like, and you are. So, no. Do you know what I'm saying? But same for like Journey, like mm-hmm. love them. Like, shout out to like all of Journey, but really, like without Perry, they're nothing. So it's kind of like that thing of like, I always feel like, and this could be wrong, white people kind of want you to be a band. So you just always feel like, well, so he had this band and I didn't think they were half bad, but his voice is like Perry. It's like, I come to you with open arms. I don't care what anybody says.
Can you talk a little bit about what Vibe magazine was like in that era? And obviously you being the music editor, I assume you had some sway or total sway over what the lead could be, but was it a source of contention amongst folks at the office? Were people like, you really banging with this? Like, why is this in the magazine? Like, what are you doing out here? Like, you coming in from the Bay Area and you putting Hootie and the Blowfish on the, what's happening?
Look. Okay. First of all, this is the thing. So 96, 97, right? When was that?
Cause I'm June, July, 96.
June, July, 96. Yes, so I was music editor,
yeah,
right?
I checked the master.
Yes. Okay, so first of all, God bless Alan Light.
Shout out
to the OG. Yes.
Shout out. Salute Alan Light.
Yeah, so Alan was EIC, and Alan gave me a lot of room to be me, which is a blessing.
Oh, is that how it works?
Alan Light gave me a lot of room to be me. And Alan has such great taste, right? And part of Alan's great taste, he passed along to me, which is just the simplest thing, to just having an open mind. And also Anthony Day Curtis, who was music editor at Rolling Stone for a long time.
Yep.
Anthony also taught me to sort of ask yourself a series of questions when you're reviewing.
Yep.
And one of them is, at the end of the day, does this have artistic merit?
Simply put.
Does it have artistic merit? And my thing was with Darius, I'm screaming from the top of my lungs, yes.
Right. It's not a debate.
Yep.
It's strange because the debate in my mind about Hootie in that era, and this is second album, so coming right off all the hits, the world-killing hits, right?
Yes, yes.
But the debate is never about, is Darius Rucker a good singer? That's never the debate. The debate is this band corny? But it's never, is Darius Rucker talented?
It never was that. But then also for me, I love pop. So it never bothered me that he was in a big band selling platinum, you know, going platinum, 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 platinum.
Right.
That he was Dave Letterman's, that's how they got so famous also.
Oh, yeah. They got off Letterman.
They were, yes, mm-hmm. They were on Letterman all the time because it was Letterman's favorite band. I was such a fan. I went to rehearsal.
No.
Why didn't I?
No.
I met Darius will tell you himself. I went to rehearsal for the Dave Letterman show to see Darius Rucker sing live because I didn't know, like, for whatever reason, if I was going to be able to see them in, you know, whatever it was, like, I wasn't going to be able to see them live that round. I heard him live in that small ass room with like almost no one in that. You know, it's like a talk show.
Right.
You know, what was it? The old CBS?
No, it's like, right. It's like in the Mercury Lounge. You know, it's like, it's like in your parents' den, you know?
Yes. And to be clear, he stopped the room. And these are people that have heard everybody. I'm talking about the guy that's like spraying Windex on the like camera lens. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Like that guy, like the girl who's bringing like the 85th cup of coffee to like the 78th person.
Mm-hmm.
She's dead in her tracks.
I believe it.
It was a moment. And he knew who I was. He liked the review. He knew I was coming. He was happy that I was black and liked his music.
Yeah. And that is something like when he and I were speaking for this most recent article, The first thing he and I spoke about was, you remember he did that R&B record in like the early 2000s?
Mm-hmm.
It was the first thing he did solo after the band. Right. And I was kind of like, you could have chosen anything, right? You could have made a roots record. You could have made a bluegrass record. Exactly. You know, were you trying to prove a point both musically and also to say, yeah, I do this, FYI. And he was like, yeah. Like, he's like, I just felt like people didn't always know. And I wanted to let those people know that I knew.
How could you listen to Darius's voice and not hear blues, which is everything that something called rhythm and blues is based in?
Absolutely.
He is the bluesiest.
The most. If anything, one of the most striking things, and maybe I shouldn't be so struck by this, but his solo country material, like subsequent to that, is probably the least bluesy of all his work. The singing is the most controlled. The production is like the crispest and the tightest. And I think it, even though I like a lot of those records, I think it kind of does him a little bit of a disservice because the really expressive part of Darius's voice is at the edges. It's that bleeding edge of blues.
Man, listen, I don't know what I was going through in the early to mid 90s. Like,
I know a little bit about it.
I'm not trying to bring like your audience into the drama of my like personal life and my, you know what
That's
I mean?
All right. We're all friends here. That's all right. But you say what you need to say.
Let her cry.
Oh, can I confess?
Anybody to cover it.
Can
anybody.
I confess? Can I confess
yes,
something?
Do. Yes.
There's no place for this in the piece that I wrote, right? But I did tell Darius this in the interview, and I don't like to generally like embarrass myself in interviews or on podcasts, to be honest. But this song in particular is so special to me, and there is a thing that happened in my life that was so absurd that I feel like, whatever, only 50,000 people listen to this show. It's fine. Like, you know, like they'll know, and then nobody else will know. Just us. Me, you, and the other 50,000 people. So I used to date a woman who had some troubles, and I made, you could call it a mixtape, you know, it was a CD, but it was, I burned it, of, I want to say 15 different live versions of Let Her Cry. Like, I searched and scoured the internet for bootlegs,
John Caravaggio,
rare ones. Mm-hmm. Oh.
You were deep in your feelings.
Woo. I mean, well, you know me, you know, I'm a bitch. I mean, you act, don't sound surprised. Why are you acting surprised?
Oh, my God. After this phone call, I need a long email, like, with an explanation and names and dates.
I might send you to MP3s.
And you know what? I would not be mad. That's the whole thing that I'm talking about. I'm sorry you went through that, John, but you know that song got you through it.
Oh, did it ever? I came out stronger.
I cry every time. The thing that got me about that song was he's so generous in that song. The lyrics are so generous toward the person that he has such strong feelings for. He gives that person so much room to be her.
At his own peril.
Yes. Right,
at his own peril.
Yes.
Oh.
I'm to misquote Whitney Houston, I'm not saying it's right, but it's okay.
It's okay.
You know what I mean?
Even though it's not.
Yes.
We're going to listen to one of these versions. I'm just picking at random here. Let Her Cry, live at Farm Aid, 1995.
Last night I tried to leave, cried to watch, I could not believe. She was the same girl I fell in love with long ago. She went in the back to get high, I sat down on my couch and cried, yelling, oh, mama, won't you hold my hand and let her cry? In the dim of that rain, let her sing. In the heat of all her pain, let her know. Let her walk right out on me. And when the sun comes up tomorrow, let her be.
So there was, so basically there wasn't institutionally any blowback for covering this in Vibe. Because I remember at the time thinking it was unusual. As a reader, I remember thinking it was unusual that it was in.
To say there was none, I think is strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know that I had no problem in my office opening my door and playing my music real loud.
Like, really? You don't say.
So people would literally come and stand in my doorway and say, like, is this really what we're doing? Like, this is what we're doing right now. I mean, this is Biggie, Tupac.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying. This is peak.
Everything was happening. And maybe that's another reason why I gravitated, because everything was happening. And we
a little bit of safe harbor away from that. Yeah.
Yes, you know, and you know, Darius's voice would just envelop you in like this emotion and sometimes coziness. People had their jokes, but I think that something that people tend to forget about Vibe too is that one of the things that I used to have either as music editor or when I was editor in chief on my wall was that we claim everything.
It's true.
I remember Santana said, and I guess he has a new album out too, talking about Africa. But when he won his, what, the Grammy for Album of the Year or Song of the Year or whatever, and he said all music is based in Africa. Like, it's all of it, everything that we do. And that's how I kind of felt at Vibe. I'm like, everything kind of goes back to like these beats and these blues, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't seem weird to me to love Darius and his little crew.
And to be frank, I mean, I think a lot of the foundation for my personal taste is built out of that era of Vibe. Because my, you know, so as you know, so many of the music critics of my generation came out of an indie rock background. You know, they came out of the Minneapolis stuff or, you know, things of that nature. And that was never my background. And for many years, I felt weirdly marginalized in that set because I was like, oh, well, I don't know anything about the Replacements. That's not my thing. But I knew where my DNA came from. My DNA came from The Source and Vibe and XXL from 93 to 97. You know what I mean? Like, that's...
came from Cameron. Let's call it what it is.
That's fine. Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Anybody wants to see my pink pants, they can. And so to see this, to be validated by this piece, I remember was very powerful for me.
I'm glad you remembered it. I want to thank you for that, actually. It's very strange to get to that point in your career, actually, where you've forgotten some of the stuff that you've written. So
I forgot what I wrote 2 months ago.
When you tweeted that out, I was like, yo, this is actually not a bad piece by me.
This is really good. No, this is. Well, I remember the thing that I remembered most about it was your kicker. And so I'm going to read that right now. But first, we're going to play. Let's play a little bit of Tuckerstown from Fairweather Johnson.
Staring back at you. Did you see my lips? Oh, you're smiling. Your father called my name, then it's out of great relief. Though there wasn't me that you were clinging to. Hey, when you turn around, you do that thing in you, and then you laugh at me.
So let's read this. So you close with Tuckerstown. Tuckerstown is a song on the record that kind of directly addresses race. And one of the interesting things in the interview that I had with Darius recently was he talked about the first album, all those big hits, Hold My Hand, etc., as protest records. He was like a black man in a white band singing about racial unity without saying race. Like, basically, songs about universal acceptance. He's like, coming from us meant something. And there was also just stuff that also didn't make the piece. The white guys in the band, Dean, Mark, Sony, you know, they formed in college. And they used to play Southern frat parties in, like, the late 80s. And they all said that there were parties where people were out there calling Darius the name that you should not be using, and
that they had
to fight their way out of some frat parties, brawling with these kids. And Sony, I think, especially, was the one. He was like, look, he's like, I didn't grow up in a particularly diverse environment, and being with Darius in those environments allowed me to see those environments for what they were through his eyes. And he's like, and it made me such a better person, and it made us such better people, and us a tighter band, because we...
a better band,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah, because we fought his fights with him because we saw them as they were happening. So that was really powerful. I wasn't able to get in the piece, unfortunately. But let's talk about, because part of what this review is about is you trying to understand if Rucker knows what you think he's about. That's part of what this review is about. So let's see. I live for Hootie and the Blowfish because Darius Rucker's voice, so plain-spoken and riffless, so ethereal, creates a space for people's sadnesses, a solid, earthy place, another place for me to cry my blues, racial and otherwise. I don't know what I can't see, he sings in Tucker's Town over and over, but I know he knows. And I remember reading that in 96 and being like, damn, like, what really came? That's, whoo, just the power of your reckoning, the power of unpacking what he's actually doing in his presentation. It just was like just a tremendous, tremendous act of criticism here.
One, thank you. And two, shout out to me, but also I always go back to Anthony and Alan, who just really kind of brought me up in this game as a critic and taught me so much. And really by that, I mean, they taught me stuff, but they also kept reminding me that, you know, I could own my thoughts about music. I could say them loudly and proudly, and whether they were popular or not. So I really owe them a lot, but I will say that I don't feel any differently today. I think that one, I think it's always super arrogant for people to decide who's like really black and who isn't. And I just always think that that's dumb. It's too complex to be a yes or no answer in any case. But I do feel like if you are wondering something about Rucker, like if you do, well, how could he really be black or something? And it's like, sometimes I think he's like the blackest. It's like, he's fighting from the other side sometimes. And his battles are not that Lord knows we all don't have ours, but it's like his battles coming up in the music business at that time in the 90s, everything, the music business remains a very segregated space.
Absolutely.
And he was on the other side shouting, man.
Yeah.
He wasn't like, you know, coming in for a sax solo or something. Like, he was the leader of the band and he was fearless with that voice. He didn't change it. He just sang out. He sang out. Like, he just sang, like you said, to the edges of everything. Like, and you just brought up Hold My Hand. It's like, that whole album, was it Cracked Review, I think? It's like
Cracked Review, yeah.
People need to hold up that album. Like,
oh, yeah. That's why I wrote the thing. I was just like, I can't believe 25 years has passed and no one has properly claimed this record for what it is. You know?
I think it's mean. I think it's short-sighted and it's mean, and I'm so glad that you did it. And, you know, on all the streaming services now, I was just looking at every place you go, it's like all the remastered versions. It sounds incredible. So he just, I think he's a treasure, and I think he's uniquely American, and I'm happy that you wrote about him, John.
I mean, you know, just following the greats. That's all I'm doing here.
Look now,
look. Hey, DSW, I'm going to let you go back to your creativity cavern. Cool?
It's been a pleasure hanging out with you, John.
Okay, are you guys?
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
I was excited. Do you guys feel the kind of communal energy, the commune that I am building around the love of Hootie and the Blowfish? Do you feel it? Are you feeling embraced by it? Do you want to be a part of it? Do you want to get the outfit? Do you want to get the merch? Great. Jim DeRogatis is calling in now, and he's going to, I think, completely disabuse you of everything that you've heard for the last episode and a half. So we're going to talk to Jim DeRogatis today. Jim has been on Popcast before. You certainly know Jim's work tirelessly detailing the allegations of sexual improprieties with minors, child pornography against R. Kelly. Jim put out a book recently taking all of the R. Kelly stuff in big picture. It's called Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly. That came out a few weeks ago. And that's why Jim was on Popcast previously to talk about R. Kelly. We're going to give Jim a respite today from that. Jim's calling in from Chicago because, Jim, let me tell you what the popular understanding is. And then you can talk me through the truth or non-truth. So from what I understand, you negatively reviewed Fairweather Johnson, which is the second Hootie record. And this is when you worked at Rolling Stone.
Yes.
And Hootie was, or Darius or whoever, was a friend of Jan Wenner, who ran the magazine and the reviews with an iron fist, and you couldn't say a bad thing about anyone who was a friend of Jan. This is certainly something
we're
that I
rails.
Heard.
Off the rails already.
Okay, well, this is what I'm. But this is certainly something I heard. Like when I was reviewing records for Rolling Stone many years later, I think maybe I like negatively reviewed like a Wyclef record or something, and someone called me and was like, "Yeah, you can't insult Wyclef." And I was like, "Really?" So anyway, that you negatively reviewed it, and that Jan was mad and pulled the review, reassigned it to a favorable review, and that you were fired over this. This is like the lore, and Hootie being the flashpoint. So I had to call you to get the truth from the source.
The truth, yeah.
So
yeah.
Speak to me, Jim. What happened in 1996?
Well, you were right about I negatively reviewed Fairweather Johnson.
Okay.
You know, I was deputy music editor. Keith Moore, my good friend, was music editor. And we were like, what are we going to do? We got this second Hootie album. They'd been on the cover of Rolling Stone for the first record. Ann Powers had written a long feature. Keith came over and was bemoaning, what the hell are we going to do? And as I often do, I espoused a theory. Look, I said, we also have this new Spin Doctors record. And we got this up-and-comer Dave Matthews Band, right? And this is all the same, man. This is all lazy white person wiggle music. This is a jam band light for people who think Bud Light is a psychedelic drug. And plus,
wow. I want to pay you $4 a word for these bars right now.
Yeah, well, you know, it was a pretty good review of a triple header, right? And I said, plus, you know, David Crosby sang on two of these three records, and he was, of course, the dead secret weapon, circa Working Man's Dead. So, you know, I wrote this review, and we had an artist had commissioned a triple header piece of art. Chris Barron from Spin Doctors.
So it was the lead. It was the lead review, correct?
It was the lead review, right? So we got a painting, you know, of Barron and Matthews and Darius. And Jan sees that, and he's upset, right? And Keith, you know, wonderfully naive, brilliant human being that he is, says he thinks Jan is upset because we are slighting Hootie. Hootie having been on the cover for the first breakthrough album. And I said, I don't think that's what he's saying. Now, mind you, in the copy department at Stone, when I was there, there was literally a sign that said, 3.5 stars is never having to say you're sorry. Because it was 5-star, you know, great.
Of course. No, I wish I knew that when I was writing reviews for Rolling Stone. No one told me that.
See, you know, they never tell you. You know, when I went to Stone.
I lived it, but no one told it to me.
No, when I went to Stone, you know, people, one person in particular who had copy edited my first book on psychedelic rock literally told me, brilliant woman, said, you know, everything you do the rest of your career will have pixie dust scattered on it. And of course, when I got fired, and Cameron Crowe, who I'm friendly with, had said, you know, it's going to be great. You're going to do great at Stone. And when I got fired, both Cameron and the editor, who'd said pixie dust, you know, both said, oh, we knew that would happen. And I'm like, well, why didn't you tell me before?
Wait, so tell me, so what is it in fact that Jan was objecting to?
You know, Jan was objecting to Hootie had sold 8.5 million copies of the first record.
And the other bands were not.
No, he didn't care about the other bands yet. In time, he would care much more about Dave Matthews and Hootie's star would wane. You know, he didn't care about the other bands, didn't know who they were. You just don't crap on something that has sold that much product. I mean, that's what 3.5 stars is never having to say you're sorry is about. If you don't like it, just go right down the middle. Don't give a negative review. Now, you can give a negative review.
You can hide a lot.
It's not selling.
You can hide a lot behind 3.5 stars.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, but, you know, like at that point, if you wanted to give a bad review to Garbage or something, right? You know, that would have been fine. But if it's a band he cared about that was selling, and he only cared about it because it was selling, I don't believe he had any relationship whatsoever with Darius.
Interesting.
You know, he certainly did with Ahmet Erdogan in the Atlantic Records machinery. And Atlantic was in the same building, you know, on 6th Avenue.
Yes, that's right.
As Hootie. So, you know, I said, I don't think that's what he means, Keith. And Keith said, no, what did you do? Pull out the Hootie review. That'll be our lead. And the other two can run as a separate joint review. I said, okay. So I rewrote it and just pulled out the Hootie. And now we had a new painting commissioned of the Hooties. And all of them this time. And they're sitting on a haystack, right? And so then, you know, it's like literally Friday afternoon. The magazine's going to press. Jan really blows a gasket, pulls that from the magazine, from the proofs, and assigns a reviewer who's genuinely well-disposed to everything. And she had
What did you rate? What was your rating?
I gave it 3 stars.
Okay, so you were making a point.
The notion that I hated Hootie, I thought they were just really blandly mediocre. I derided the lyrics for the Hallmark card banality, which was especially hard to take compared to the sophomoric sex puns of the titles, right, of the album, Coochie Pop and Cracked Rear View. And, you know, if you recall that Ann Powers Rolling Stone cover story, they're driving around in the bus and ogling co-eds. I mean,
they were a frat band.
This was Brett Kavanaugh times 4. You know, that's how I saw them. But I didn't hate them. I said in the review they were the musical equivalent of Milk and Cookies. And so, you know, so Jan pulled it, and the reviewer who was assigned had like 1 hour. So, you know, censorship is never heavy-handed. It's implied. You know, you got an hour to review Hootie. It's the lead review. We're going to pay you double because, like, you know, you got to turn it around. It's like it doesn't have to be said, make it a good review. But I didn't get fired for writing that review. See, I went home, and we had a lot of enemies, Keith Moore and I, at Rolling Stone. Basically everybody who worked there. And somebody tipped off the New York Observer, you know, which was the weekly paper pre-Jared Kushner owning it, that covered inside media gossip in New York. So they called me at home.
And very said, well. This is yeah, that yeah, was they were did a good job. They excelled at it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, Friday night, Keith is drinking his second bottle of wine. I'm at home. My wife's 7.5 months pregnant in Hoboken, and I get a call from the New York Observer. You know, we heard this story. Jan Winter spiked a negative Hootie review. And I said, I can't talk to you. Now, this went against the last time I was on Popcast. We're talking about 19 years of investigative reporting about R. Kelly, which cost me considerable angst and problems in my life.
Yes.
But it was an important story, and those problems pale in comparison to the people he hurt. You were here in my house. We were talking about it for the Times. You know, so I hate to say no comment. What a weaselly thing to do. And they said, well, you know, just talk to us. And I said, well, really, I can't. I was desperately trying to get out of Stone. I was trying to get back to Chicago or freelance or anything besides Stone. But, you know, like the wife wasn't working and she was pregnant. And this is a little bit of pressure. So
life.
So they, you know, the reporter finally said, well, answer me one question. Is Jan Winter a Hootie fan? And I said, I quote, "That son of a bitch is a fan of anything that sells 8.5 million copies."
Well, there you go.
And that ran in bold in a pull quote with his picture. And so there you go. I mean, it's kind of like the person who's chronically depressed and steps in front of the bus. Was that an act intentional? Was that a mistake? Was that just the fog of everything in life? Right. And so, yeah, I mean, I went in Monday morning and I, you know, took the bus to Port Authority and then walked to 6th Avenue and, you know, Rolling Stones headquarters. And they had thoughtfully packed up my desk to security guards. And I was ushered to personnel where I was told New York's a right to work state. And I was out the door. Now, Keith got fired.
Were you relieved?
Well, except for the part with the 7.5 month pregnant wife and right. No discernible income. And having been fired from Rolling Stone, would I ever work in, you know, music journalism again? I was a weird mix of relief and utter fear and panic. And then Keith got fired, too. But he got to finish the next issue. And then he got, in exchange for a non-disclosure agreement, a umbrella farewell package. I got nothing. I don't even think I got my last check.
Oy.
Yeah. So it was but it was my big mouth, John. I mean, you know, be clear.
Well, sure.
It was my big mouth that got me fired. It was not, you know.
The crime of disliking Hootie and the Blowfish.
Yeah, but I never forgave Tim Sommer because he was giving me crap. You know, like, again, they worked in the same building. You know, I had friends who were publicists at Atlantic, and, you know, yeah. I was friends with Tim forever. He used to sit in with the Love Pushers at Maxwell's and stuff. We'd cover Modern Lovers, Modern World. And, you know, I had seen Hugo Largo a million times. I'd written about them. You know, we were buddies. And, you know, he was like, you know, how could you do this? They were good, hardworking people. And these are some of the arguments, Mr. Karamanica, that you made at great length. I do not understand how they gave you such length for that story. You know, I mean, look, we all have indefensible guilty pleasures. You know,
There's no such thing as guilty pleasure.
I agree. I was 12 years of Catholic school. I've been shaking that off my entire life. No. If it's a pleasure, you shouldn't be guilty. I'm a popist in that regard.
That's exactly right.
I will not apologize for loving Bad Out of Hell by Meatloaf or the Black Eyed Peas or Smash Mouth. I mean, you know.
Right.
So, you know, for me, it's those three. For you, it was Hootie. But you cannot say, you know, they were an important band. I would not say they were a good band. I wouldn't say they were a bad band, but they certainly were not an important band.
I feel very strongly. I think important.
I know there were like 80,000 words you wrote.
Yes, that's right. And I sweated over each of those 80,000 words. I sweat. I'm sweating right now, even thinking about it. But to that point, importance, obviously, the calibration is different ways to calibrate importance.
Well, yeah, you know. I mean, look, it was good for the industry. It was one of the last good times for the industry. And then you got the influx of teen pop and rap rock. It became Limp Bizkit, NSYNC, and Backstreet Boys and Britney. You know, and, you know, look, years later, Peter Holsapple, I was a huge DBs fan, and REM, of course, you know, and Holsapple, I don't know if he was forgiving me or joking about it. He came on, the DBs came on Sound Opinions, and he said, you know, yeah, played with Hootie for the health insurance. You know, and that was a line I'd had. He's like, what a waste of Peter Holsapple. He's like clearly only in the band for health insurance. But yeah, I bet that's more money than he ever made as a musician in his entire career. And ironically, then he went on to work with Healthcare for Indigent New Orleans Musicians. So he understood.
And he still plays with, you know, still plays with Hootie to this day.
It's a good paycheck, I'm certain.
I'm certain it is. I did speak to Tim Sommer earlier, and in Sommer's opinion, and I think in mine as well, Hootie is a lot closer to that DB's REM thing than I think is ordinarily, than they're ordinarily kind of allowed to be considered as because of the nature of their breakthrough. You don't feel it.
Only until you listen to the music. You know, I mean, in theory, they were geographically and in certain social circles concentric. But, you know, I mean, no. I stand by my original review. Lazy white person.
So you haven't changed. That was like the last thing I wanted to know. There's nothing that is. Did you like Cracked Rear View?
No. But to I you, hate it.
I agree. Fairweather is a lesser record, but you didn't like even the big one.
No, I didn't hate it, but I didn't like it. It was there. It was milk and cookies. You know, and I'm not talking like a quality cookie. I'm not talking like, you know, Oreos like that you kept in the freezer, right?
Oh, you're talking like a Hydrox. You're talking like a Hydrox,
I'm talking like generic grocery store oatmeal
cookie.
Nilla
wafer.
Oatmeal. No. Nilla wafers can be really good, especially when you have an upset stomach. No, I'm talking like the generic, slightly stale oatmeal cookie. Now, one could argue that a bad cookie is better than no cookie, and it depends on the circumstances. You know, I mean, yeah, whatever. You're driving along or you're painting the house and that comes on the radio. You're not going to jump off the ladder to go turn it off. But, you know, neither is it like Funkadelic coming on the radio or Wire or Public Enemy.
I didn't expect that your opinion had changed at all, but I felt like I at least needed to know.
I am capable of admitting that I've reconsidered, certainly, many things. You know, I don't think any critic who doesn't occasionally double back on herself is worth reading. You know, and Lester Banks taught me that when I was 17, when I interviewed him.
Absolutely right.
You know, I mean, he initially despised Exile on Main Street. Then the next issue of Cream declared it the best album ever made. You know, had back and forths about the MC5 or Patti Smith, you know. So no, you know, I would certainly, and in fact, I read all of the 123,000 words of your article, and I carefully considered them. I mean, we bonded, you and I, and I respected your work even before we ever talked. You know, and I'm just like, what did I miss here? You know.
But I didn't convince you. Nothing sold you.
No. And I believe Somer got like a gold-plated Rolls Royce or something. I'm exaggerating. I believe.
Wow.
You know. Yeah, ask him about what the like bonus was.
He should give us a ride.
Ask him about what the bonus was for the Hootie's success. Man. And see if he's honest with you. And I don't, you know, look, that was the business. That was the business.
Yeah,
but what I never forgave him for was gloating. Another publicist friend of mine at Atlantic sent me a bouquet of flowers and like, you know, sorry this happened to you, Jim, which was, I thought, very sweet. But Somer and one or two others kind of like rubbed dirt in the wound. Like, what were you expecting, Jim? And I was like, well, I was a critic expecting to like run my critique. You know, I would never. Now, to be clear, as deputy music editor, I would have assigned a second cover story on Hootie. Because I am fascinated about why the equivalent of milk and cookies connected with so many people, especially.
And I do think it's important. Yeah. And I'm glad you're saying this because I do like I just recently pretty negatively reviewed Lil Nas X, right? His EP. And it's so strange to see how criticism has been kind of like bastardized in the popular understanding. Like it's been reduced to hatred or some kind of dismissal. Criticism to me, and I'm sure you feel the same, criticism is an act of love. It's an act of generosity. It's an act of giving the fullness of my attention and my care and my curiosity to this work of art.
It doesn't mean I'm going to love a sadomasochistic undertaking. You know, I mean, in order to spend, in order to write a decent review of that Hootie record or Dave Matthews or Spin Doctors, you know, I mean, I had to spend hours and I listened a half dozen times or more with each. I mean, you know, and like after the first listen, when you're like, don't like this, right? I mean, why do you keep listening? I mean, because you're going to do it right.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And it's not about liking or not liking. Like I feel like criticism just gets reduced to like or don't like, but it's not about that. It's context. It's big picture. It's also like a foil for your personal ideologies that you develop in real time as you're engaging with the art. And I wish more people understood that. But, you know, I wish a lot of things.
You know, yeah, I know. I think criticism is a discussion. You know, it's a discussion between people who care passionately about the art. And no critic who's worth reading ever considers herself the last word on a subject.
Absolutely.
She just
not.
Wants
Correct.
To start the conversation. That's
Absolutely.
What podcast is about. That's what Sound Opinions
Sound
is about.
Sound Opinions is about. Yep.
Yeah. And so, hey, look, I had no animus toward Hootie. In fact, maybe only like 5 years ago, My wife and I went out to buy, my permanent wife, and I went out to buy an appliance at this far-flung Apt in Chicago. It's a pain in the neck to get to. It's out in the burbs, and like, you know, you spend all day there. We're buying stove or whatever, and then we're riding back. We're like, oh, let's go to dinner. And we went to dinner, and, you know, who walks in but Darius and like six friends?
Amazing.
And I was like, oh, I can't believe it. You know, and I, you know, I'd never met him. I'd never talked to him. I don't think he would remember. I think I'm in one of the Hootie books, you know, and they get it wrong. Everything gets it wrong, you know. But the truth is, it was my big mouth got me fired.
Wait, so did you talk to Darius?
No.
Oh, I thought that was going to be the kicker.
No,
I thought the kicker was like you went and like gave him a hug or something.
No, you know, as the boys sat down, it was quite obvious they had just come off the links and they'd already had a few, and they proceeded to knock back quite a few more.
Sure.
And I would look, if I'm at a restaurant this weekend and I run into Brett Kavanaugh, I ain't going to go say hello to him either.
Okay. Jim, I am saddened to know that my 246,000 words of praise for Hootie and the Blowfish fell on deaf ears in Chicago. I'm so sorry.
It was a fascinating piece, and I admire the courage. You know, you really stood up in front of an auditorium full of people in only your underwear.
That is exactly what my plan was, and I am glad. If anybody, honestly, if I wanted anyone to appreciate me doing that, it's you.
I absolutely did. I absolutely did. There's all this, you know, everybody on Facebook and the Twitters, you know, wanted me to say, you know, like, what the hell is wrong with John? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I will argue to my dying day that Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf is a better album than Darkness on the Edge of Town by Springsteen.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
No, I could write 973,000 words.
I hope you do. I hope you do.
Yeah, nobody wants that book. I have a lot of books nobody wants, brother.
Oh, Jim. Yo, man, thank you so much for your time and for your grace under Darius and Hootie fire. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, but you know, it was just a stupid. If it hadn't been that, it would have been something else.
Right, exactly. That's how I think about many things in my life.
You know, yeah, and it worked out. You know, if you're going to, look, here's a life lesson to all the kids, right? If you are going to go down in flames, you might as well go down as spectacularly as possible. So, you know, now I'm the guy who got fired from Rolling Stone, right? But, you know, I was in good company. The first record review editor, Greil Marcus, lasted 8.5 months. He was fired for panning a Dylan album, one of the horrible, like, converted to Christianity Dylan albums that nobody likes. And the second record review editor, Ed Ward, was fired after 8.5 months. And I was fired after 8.5 months. I think that's like, you know, if you go there with, you know, opinions and you're going to stick to them, that's about how long you last.
Right. And that's the rock stars dying at 27 of music criticism.
Yes. You know, unless you're, you know, a lifer like David Frick, who still didn't make it his whole life. But
Jim, a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, John.
I do owe you a hot dog when I'm in Chicago next time.
Oh, we can do better than that.
Okay, well, you can pick the spot. I'll just show up.
All right, you bet.
Going out, let's play a kind of slept-on gem from the Rucker R&B record. That record's called Back to Then. It came out in 2002. Darius told me that Atlantic basically refused to put it out, which is kind of an insane thing considering how popular Hootie and the Blowfish had been for the 5 or 6 years prior to that. They basically didn't want to touch it. So it came out on Hidden Beach. Hidden Beach, as you guys may know, was like a sort of neo-soul label that was popping in the early 2000s. So this album came out on Hidden Beach. So let's play. I'm not going to play the Snoop Dogg song. There is a song with Snoop on this. It's called Sleeping in My Bed. I'm not going to play this, although Darius did do a very funny Snoop impression when I asked him about this record. Something like, "That's you, D-Row," or something crazy like that. We're not going to play that, but let's play something a little bit more tender. There's a duet with Jill Scott on this record. It's called Sometimes I Wonder. So let's hit a little bit of that Rucker Jill Scott.
See you. see you again. You make me feel like I've seen the sun. Your loving lets me know that I'm the only one that I hear.
Sometimes I wonder.
I wonder how you got so good.
Sometimes I wonder.
I wonder how you got.
That is our show this week. Thank you to Danielle Smith for bringing the love, to Jim DeRogatis for bringing the friction. Grateful to them. And that concludes our two-part Hootie cast. Thank you for riding with me from top to bottom on this. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Feel free to go back and listen to part one of Hootie cast and then part two again. Just maybe put them on a playlist, just the two of them, and just play them over and over and over again. I think it's a good educational experience. You know, we've had two very bright critics today taking starkly opposing positions. Email me where you fall on this debate at podcast@nytimes.com and subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get audio, on your phones, on your computers, on your implant chips, wherever that might be. Subscribe. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We will be back next week.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.